It is a great pleasure to open our academic year in terms of the Center for Corporate and Commercial Law, the 3CL, in having Mark Rowe and Roy Shapiro presenting on the power of the narrative in corporate law making. Before I turn to Mark and Roy, and I'll introduce you, I'd like to introduce Louise Gulliver, who's also attending, and I'll promote her later when we do the Q&A to the panel. I'm mentioning Louise because Louise is just starting as 3CL co-director, and I'm very much looking forward to working with Louise in the future. Louise is the Rouse Ball Chair of English Law at this faculty, and she's interested in commercial law, financial law, especially secured transactions and financial collateral, intermediate securities, set-off, and personal property. Those of you taking the corporate finance course will be familiar with her book on corporate finance, which she co-authors with Jennifer Payne from Oxford University. She also leads the Cape Town Convention Academic Project, and this gives me an opportunity to point you to our website, the 3CL website, where you have more information on this project, and we owe the beautiful website in terms of the convention to Louise. Now, turning to Mark and Roy, it's a great pleasure having you here. I think also starting with the theme of narratives to start our year is really great. Mark Rowe, in case he still needs to be introduced, is a professor at Harvard Law School, and he teaches corporate law and corporate bankruptcy. His research interests cover bankruptcy, corporate bankruptcy and reorganization, corporate law and corporate finance. Now, you know, Mark, when I looked at your website, you know, looking for your bio, I found it very interesting that essentially your bio is your publications. So you're telling people very clearly what you're really interested in. So I thought I should pick two of them. And that is Strong Managers and Weak Owners, 1994, The Political Roots of American Corporate Finance. And the second is just because I'm also interested in insolvency, or as you call it, bankruptcy, the book called Bankruptcy and Corporate Reorganizations, 2014. I'm also, I should say, I'm very grateful to Anna Christie, you mentioned her, for establishing contact between us. And it's a great pleasure having you virtually here, Mark. Roy Shapiro is the co-author of the paper that will be presented. He's associate professor at the Ratzinger Law School of IDC. It's a great pleasure meeting you, Roy. We haven't met before. I read from your website that you are interested in reputation, regulation, and corporate governance, and you've got a connection to Cambridge, and that is that your law on, oh, sorry, your book on law and regulation has just been published in September 2020. So if you visit the bookstores, the books are still probably warm when you touch them. So don't miss that out and get a copy. Now it's great to have the participants in the virtual room. And we will start off with the presentation, but after that, we'll have an opportunity for questions and answers. And could I please invite everyone attending to submit questions using the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom screen. Now, why I'm asking you to submit questions in writing is that I'll look at the questions, then I'll promote you to speak. So you'll have an opportunity to ask them in person, but should that for some reason fail due to microphone failure or other failure, I would then have the opportunity to read out the question to you. So please you know, mention these, as this is our first seminar of the academic year and some of you have just arrived in Cambridge. Please do not be shy, write down your questions because the questions and the discussion is a major part of our meeting here. Just to say that the attendees can't use their microphones or cameras throughout the presentation, but as mentioned, I will promote you to speak in terms of the questions. And then if that is okay, I will then also mention your name and asking you to speak. The way we run these seminars is that we will record the presentation, but after the presentation is over, then it's for the presenters to decide whether they would like it to be published or not. We will in no case publish the Q&A, because we feel that we should have an environment where everyone is comfortable to speak and ask questions. So So the Q&A will not be published. And I think that also solves our data protection issues here. This is all that I wanted to say. And I'm very pleased to hand over to Mark and Roy. Mark, I think you might want to share your screen, but I think you can do that if in case you want to, in case you have slides. And thank you very much again for coming to us virtually. I was about to say so early for you, but okay, you had breakfast, I got that. And I'm very much looking forward to your presentation and also Roy's involvement. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for that introduction, Felix. There are a lot of disadvantages of this lockdown and COVID-19. This is actually one of the advantages, this kind of event, in that I think we wouldn't have organized something like this. Felix wouldn't have organized. I wouldn't have participated a year ago, because looking at the physical transportation between Cambridge, Boston, and Cambridge, UK, to go over for a weekend, it wouldn't happen. But one advantage of our new gained facility with Zoom is we can do these things. Not as good as being there in person, but better than not doing this at all. What I thought first is to try to motivate this. I'm estimating that most people haven't gotten a chance to read the paper, and I've got a few polling questions. In some ways, this you'll see as we get through it. This is research for Roy and me. I've got a few questions. They're really attuned to people who haven't read the paper, but I tried to phrase them in a way so that even somebody who's read the paper could participate successfully. So there are two candidates for CEO at a company, and the directors are looking, and the candidates are equal in all respects except one. They have the same track record, the same same success, failure rate, same CV. One, though, has a reputation when the headhunter company and the board calls around. One has a reputation for being short-term. The other has a reputation for being long-term. In all other respects, they're identical. And so a conscientious board will usually choose the short-term candidate or the long-term candidate. And, well, we've got a trend. Maybe I ought to ask all of them simultaneously, although it looks like people are voting on each one of them. There's supposed to be a sequence. The sequence is then, after we've done that, the second question is same board, just as conscientious. This time one candidate is reputed to be adaptable and the other is reputed to be steadfast. The conscientious board will go for which one, the adaptable or the steadfast? And then the third question is same choice, same kind of choice. First candidate is reputed to be flexible. Second is pigheaded and rigid. We finally got some division in the polling. Let me see if I can publish this. So here are the results. It looks like 18 people voted. One would go with a short-term candidate, 17 with a long-term candidate, 17 would go with the adaptable candidate, one would go with the steadfast candidate, and all 18 would go for the candidate reputed to be flexible, and nobody would go with the pig-headed and rigid candidate. Okay? And if you haven't read the paper, you'll see in a few moments the relevance of the poll. Let me see. If I've clicked properly. Stop share results. If I've clicked properly, you should see a screen that shows a choice between short term and long term. Okay, good. So what's our image of short-term stock trades? It's kind of this. There's a little data because almost everything now is done by computer entry. But I think most of us, if we looked at, if we tried to form an image of stock trading, this is the kind of image I have of frenzied brokers looking for a slight advantage in price, trying to get their profitable trade in before the New York Stock Exchange closing bell rings. So this is the title of the paper. Felix has already introduced it, The Power of the Narrative in Corporate Law. And Roy and I have been working on this for a little while. And let me give you the motivation for the paper. Corporate lawmaking, for the most part, is really made outside of the public eye. So most corporate law issues, and maybe I'm projecting the United States, but I suspect it's the same thing in the UK. Most corporate law issues are decided by corporate lawyers, the interests, corporate law judges, and occasionally a legislature, with the legislature frequently delegating the issues to corporate law experts. And the two biggest inputs into corporate law making are going to be interest group pushes and the lawmaker's view of what's the best result. Public opinion is usually secondary, absent, makes no difference. So examples in the United States in the last few years, there's been controversy over the appraisal remedy in corporate law. I would say that public opinion has zero impact on what the rules are. It's all a question of what do the corporate law judges think? What do the litigators have to say? Occasionally, some of the players read one of our academic articles for deciding whether to go this way or go that way. There are some corporate law issues that attract significant public and media attention. There aren't that many, but there are several that do. And I think there's reason to believe that with increased populism, more density of social media, these will have some greater impact in the future. Some examples, corporate purpose is a big topic almost everywhere nowadays. Executive compensation, a little bit less powerful today than it was 5 years ago, but it's still there. Stock buybacks get a lot of attention in the media, and United States senators who have no clue about the appraisal remedy, don't even know what it is, have strong opinions on stock buybacks. And the topic for this paper, short-termism. And there are two channels in which these public opinion can end up having an impact on corporate lawmaking. One is just directly. Public opinion indicates how voters will vote. Politicians want votes to be reelected. And so for some politicians, they don't register an issue on the merits, but if they think that stock buybacks are unpopular, it becomes unpopular for them for strategic reasons. And then for some lawmakers who are viewing things on the merits, public opinion will influence their view of the merits. So if they see the public and the media largely inveighing against stock buybacks or excessive short-termism, they're just a little bit more likely to come to view that short-termism is a negative feature and stock buybacks are starving the corporation. So. With a little bit of extra background here that's only summarized in the paper. When you look at the academic literature on short-termism versus long-termism, it's actually sharply divided. The data on our firms excessively paying attention to their quarterly results or our hedge funds excessively inducing short-term orientation in companies. When you go through the finance papers, they're almost equally divided. If one were agnostic and then just looking at the literature, you wouldn't come away from the literature if you're just giving a vote to every article saying we've got a deep consensus that short-termism is a serious problem. Yet it's one of the few corporate issues that garners attention from from politicians. Biden's paid attention to it. Hillary Clinton had it as a major issue in her 2016 campaign. Elizabeth Warren, my former colleague, has inveighed against short-termism. Trump has tweeted against short-termism as well. So the basic motivation is there's a disconnect between the academic evidence, which is at most mixed, and the public view that we've got a serious problem. And the question that Roy and I investigate for this paper is, why is there this disconnect? Our investigation is not what is the truth, although truth feeds into what people actually believe, but why is the public discourse one-sided and the academic discourse divided? First thing, and this is going to be relevant, it seems just definitional at first, what do we mean by stock market short-termism? So there's one narrative for stock market short-termism. It's sacrificing long-term profits of the corporation for a short-term gain. It's a time horizon problem. And there's another short-term narrative that the corporation is sacrificing long-term social value, putting the planet at risk for climate degradation, polluting the environment, degrading stakeholders. And all of these are frequently, often, almost always in the media and from politicians labeled as short term. But we think it's better to call this either social short termism or a social problem as opposed to a time horizon problem. So they overlap. There are going to be some social problems that are time horizon problems and vice versa. But a large number of these are disjoint. We wouldn't say that a firm that if an oil pipeline leaked over the long term for 30 years, we wouldn't say, oh, that's okay because it's long term. It's an environmental problem, and in some ways it's much worse because it's long term than if it's short term. So by short-termism, we mean the time horizon problem, that something in the a corporation that's excessively short-term mistakenly and perniciously favors current results over longer-term results. And the economic consequences will be it will not invest in long-term equipment. It'll do less research and development. It will let cash drain away, even though it has good uses for the cash. And these three things, failure to invest, R&D, cash drain, are actually closely contested in the finance literature. So further motivation, we tend to think that the short-termism time horizon problem is exaggerated. It's real, but it's a secondary or tertiary problem, and it's kind of part and parcel of having having firms with public stockholders, and there are bigger fish to fry in public policy. But we think both people who think like us that it's an overdone problem, and people who think that it's seriously pernicious, should be interested in what we have to say. Everybody should be interested in what we have to say. And the reason people who think it's a serious and pernicious problem should be interested is we all know we've got some great ideas for policymakers that never make it out of our office or our academic papers. Short-termism is one that's made it out of the offices of people who think short-termism is a problem. And there are substantial political allies for the view that short-termism is a problem. So our thesis is the explanation for the disconnect between the lack of an academic consensus and the substantial public consensus is the connotation in the words, and that was the reason for the poll, category confusion and confirmation. Let me just repeat this for people who haven't gotten a chance to look at the paper. The short-termism idea has very favorable selling characteristics. The connotation for short-termism is negative. We don't want it. My recollection from the poll is 17 out of the 18 people responding said, go for the long-term candidate, don't go for the short-term candidate. It's an easy concept to understand. And short-term, we'll go into this a little bit more, but short-term carries a negative connotation. Close synonyms don't carry the same negative connotation. Category confusion, the point I was just making is that there are a lot of things that are called short-termism, including environmental degradation and disrespect for stakeholders, that are in large measure externalities, third-party effects, and not really a time horizon problem. And then the third is there are interests who profit from lawmakers thinking short-termism is a big problem, and they have reason to repeat the idea. It's easy to repeat by people who don't have an interest, and it's easy to repeat by people who do have an interest in its repetition. So the imagery fits. Short-term, who would want these people running firms with 30-year horizons? So some examples of the political discourse. Marty Lipton, who has probably a more substantial profile in corporate lawmaking in the United States than in the UK, because he's American, not British, began this several decades ago, where he says it would not be unfair to pose the policy issue as to whether the long-term interests of the nation's corporate system and economy should be jeopardized to benefit speculators, the traders in the image of the chart that I just had. And Lipton's pressed this claim for decades, and it's a claim that benefits managers. I believe it's sincerely believed by most, all, many, but it's also something that that benefits managers, in that the most natural policy result for somebody who believes that it's the stock market that is inducing excessive short-termism would be to insulate boards and executives from the stock market. So in corporate discourse, it's regularly repeated. So here's Joe Biden, if you haven't been watching, the current candidate for president in the United States, 3 weeks to go till the election. So Joe Biden, when he was, it was just after he decided not to run in 2016, says short-termism, the notion that companies forego long-run investment, is one of the greatest threats to America's enduring prosperity. And when he explicates, it's that short-termism hurts workers. And he repeated it a couple of months ago in an interview with David Brooks. Biden, when asked to describe the big forces that are flattening working class wages, points to the broken system in Washington and Wall Street forcing business leaders to focus obsessively on the short term. So it's this triad, connotation, confirmation, and category confusion, that we think drives the wedge between the academic lack of consensus and the public consensus. I should say, as a matter of methodology, we can't, you know, we kind of prefer to do things where there's a logical necessity or something that could be regressed. This is kind of speculative thought, but the speculative thought taps into of the behavioral economics literature in a major way, in that there are things happening in the behavioral economics literature that fits nicely the argument that we're making. And the narrative, if there's time, I'd like to spend a couple of minutes, the narrative can boost interest group influence. So this was essentially the poll. Almost everybody said prefer the long-term candidate for the short over the short-term candidate. The long-term candidate is favored by these connotations of somebody being strategic, steadfast, constant, I could add reliable. The short-term candidate is unstable, lacks a plan, is unreliable, volatile. I would prefer the long-term candidate if these characteristics come with a long-term candidate, and I prefer that over the short-term candidate. If we just change to synonyms with positive connotations, well, we're no longer told that the candidate is short-term, but the candidate is flexible and adaptable, can turn on a dime when we get new information. And the long-term candidate is immutable, rigid. We see a switch in the poll. You'll remember most people switched and said, well, we want the flexible and adaptable candidate. We don't want the rigid and unchanging candidate. And I think that's the way most people and most boards will think. But in substantial measure, the flexible candidate is short term and the rigid candidate is long term. I guess the idea is some long term thinking is rigid and some long term thinking is strategic, and some short term thinking is adaptation to new circumstances, and some of it is unreliable change. So short term connotations are bad. Long term connotations are good. And in the behavioral economics literature, Kahneman in particular, but all of them say the same thing, initial reactions are critical. Once we have an initial reaction from, say, connotation, we need a very powerful crowbar to move us. Most of us can move, but we need to be persuaded once we have a significant initial reaction. And the analytic really doesn't favor long over short or short over long. The corporation should be run for the short term if it's in the buggy whip business and needs to get out, and should be run for the long term if it's doing electric cars that will dominate at the end of the next decade. Back up, besides the research we just did with the poll, the differences, we did look at the major dictionaries, and they all have the same connotation difference. The definition of short-term embeds a negative connotation, and the definition of long-term is somewhere between neutral and positive. This is Webster's Dictionary, Merriam-Webster's Dictionary, and even the Financial Times, your newspaper, which is not particularly anti-finance, they have some definitions in one of their publications, and they do the same thing. Short-term is a negative that we want to avoid. Long-term is a positive that we want, and they don't switch to adaptable versus rigid pigheaded. So our first is connotation. The connotation sets the stage for most people's thinking. The second is category confusion. The category confusion is that there are a lot of things that are really not primarily and not even secondarily time horizon problems that are called short term. Such as criticisms of the corporation for degrading the environment, and frequently the tag that's included with it is it degrades the environment because stockholders are too short-term oriented. The fundamental problem is an externality, is that the corporation that pollutes doesn't pay, and it's outsiders that pay. The externality is in place whether the pollution is short-term, just today and tomorrow, or long-term over the next two or three decades. Same thing for disrespect for stakeholders. If the corporation fails to treat communities, employees, and the like respectfully, this is often labeled as short-term, when again, it's somewhere between a distributional consideration or an externality. And the same thing for financial risk-taking. The big problem in the financial crisis, particularly in the United States, was that financial institutions were taking risks with their own well-being, but 93% of the costs were borne by outsiders when the financial system imploded in 2009. Again, an externality. These things are regularly often viewed as a time horizon, short-term problem. And that leads to two things. One is, since for most speakers, environmental degradation, disrespect, and financial risk-taking are all negatives, short-termism seems even worse than it is, because it includes these third-party effects. Equally, maybe more importantly for purposes of our thesis, short-termism seems to be more rampant than it actually is, in that every time a corporation pollutes, if that's labeled as short-term, even if it's 20-year pollution, the recipient of the message says, it's another short-term problem. Okay, so we've got this narrative of externalities, which is labeled as short-term, which expands the perniciousness and the extent of short-termism in popular and media thinking. The third aspect of the thesis is repetition. Roy and I, particularly Roy, put together a lot of the information from the behavioral economists and the behavioral psychologists, that repetition fosters belief, and this is one of the bedrock findings of this literature. Simple repetition leads more people to believe in the truth of the statement. This has become politically toxic in the United States in particular, but this applies to things that are less toxic, like beliefs in short-termism. Advantage of short-termism in terms of repetition, it's an easy idea to communicate. People who have no knowledge about financial markets have some sense of what short-termism is. And then there are interests that have a reason to repeat and confirm to lawmakers that we've got a short-term problem. Representatives of management have a reason to believe in short-termism. Beliefs often follow interests. There is evidence of short-termism, so they're not making it up out of whole cloth. They have a reason to repeat it to lawmakers, to Delaware corporate law judges, to indicate we've got a short-termism problem, so shield the managers. So that's the thesis. Maybe I'll just a little bit more detail on the third prong of the thesis. There are two interests that have a reason to repeat. One is managers who sincerely believe, but then benefit from a widespread belief. And stakeholders have a reason to repeat the short-termism thesis. When Biden states it, when Hillary Clinton stated it, when Liz Warren stated it, they were not defending management and boards. They wanted more for employees and stakeholders. And I think there's an explanation for it. The explanation, I think, is it's still not politically astute in the United States to attack the basics of capitalism. By attacking short-termism, in the last few years, attacking or seeking an expanded corporate purpose, one can tap into things that are the best of capitalism as opposed to the negatives of capitalism. So rhetorically, there's more strength in a politician saying, I don't like Wall Street and Wall Street is pernicious, although some can. But somebody trying to assemble a wide coalition like Biden or Hillary Clinton will not want to attack Wall Street, but say, I want to bring forth the best in Wall Street. And the best in Wall Street is long-term investing, not short-term investing that degrades stakeholders. The last substantive point, there are some public choice connections that we think are potentially important. Some of them I've already alluded to, but just let's state it explicitly. There's significant evidence that people who want something from the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Delaware judges bring forth short-termism. You can fight short-termism, Justice Strine, our long-time leading corporate law judge. You can fight short-termism by doing this, usually insulate managers further from stock markets. Why is the short-termism argument important? One is for many people, they think it's true. And if they think it's true, persuading somebody of the truth is good, gets them what they want. But there's another reason, an interest that simply said, we contribute to campaigns, we influence who gets appointed to the judiciary and who influences who will get appointed as a Securities and Exchange Commissioner. We hold the money and the purse strings, so do what we want. In the United States, I suspect in the UK also, if a reporter got a hold of that conversation, this would be a major headline for, certainly for the New York Times business section, and I think for the Wall Street Journal as well. Interests are trying to assert their muscle to get what they want. Much better for an interest group to say they're seeking the public interest, which also benefits them, by the way, by trying to fight short-termism. A public regarding rationale is usually necessary, and raw political power frequently generates a backlash. The acceptable way to criticize capitalism, I've already done, so we don't have to do it again. We can skip this. So the conclusion, I'm interested in your questions and comments. The conclusion is it's really hard to explain on the facts and the data that's available why stock market short-termism is so widely believed. Our explanations as to the widespread belief are grounded in behavioral economics and knowledge of connotations from the dictionaries. There are other things that we think could benefit from this kind of analysis, corporate purpose, stock buybacks. But for now, this is the only one that we're doing. And the conclusion we have is three things generate the widespread media and political belief in short-termism. And it's not the data. No United States senator. You may have a different group of people as members of parliament, but I can guarantee you that there is no United States senator who is reading the Journal of Finance and weighing the short-termism versus there's no short-termism articles before he or she comes to a conclusion. The three things that I think that we think drive this are connotations. The connotations of short-termism, as we saw in the polling before we started this this event, the connotations of short-termism are negative. The connotations of long-termism are positive. Short-term players are unreliable. Long-term players are steadfast and loyal. Category confusion, there are a lot of things that really aren't a time horizon problem that are categorized as one. And so it seems more pernicious and more widespread. And then it's an easy idea to repeat. It's easy for a journalist to make the case. It's easy for a politician to understand time horizons and short-termism. And there are interests who want to repeat it. So that's it. Our view. Every time we think about it a little bit more, we want to change something in the title, not just the power of the narrative in corporate lawmaking, but the highly persuasive power of the narrative in corporate lawmaking. So I'm interested in what all you all have to say.